I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today's Monday, February 3rd. The time is 3:31 p.m. Present today, committee members, Senator Faircloth, Senator French, Senator Machiki, and myself, Senator Giesel. I believe that Senator Dyson will be joining us a bit later. So, welcome. Today, our recording secretary is Ann Krekelberg, and our LIO IT person is Sam Greeley. And I just want to stop, you know, a lot of times these folks sit in the background and they do a tremendous job. They are actually creating a legal document and facilitating the public to interact with us. So I sincerely appreciate both of you guys. Also, I appreciate Lindsay Williams, my staff, who prepares our documents and the meetings. So our meeting today has two parts to it. The first part is going to focus on general gas line key themes, and the second part will be on the plan for the Alaska LNG project. So the meeting may extend past 5 p.m. We'll see if that's needed or not. So presenting first, we have our consultants, Janik Mayer and Nikos Safus from Analytica. They're going to give a brief presentation, and they're going to leave a lot of time for questions and discussion. So they're going to go through just a few slides, and then we're going to have lots of time for questions. During the second half of the meeting, Steve Butt, senior project engineer, will take us through the elements of the Alaska LNG project. So Mr. Mayer and Mr. Safus, if you'd come to the table and introduce yourself for the record. Also, the record should reflect that Senator McGuire has joined us, so welcome.
For the record, Janik Mayer, partner in Analytica. This is now, I think, my third year up here working with the state legislature on oil and gas issues. For the last 2 years, of course, working on issues around oil tax reform, and now back once more to talk about gas commercialization. Formerly, of course, here with PSC Energy, now with my colleague Nikos, who many of you will know, particularly from the natural gas symposium that we did in Anchorage last year, here under the new guise of Analytica. I'll hand it over to Nikos to introduce himself.
For the record, Nikos Safos, partner at Analytica, thank you. Madam Chair, thank you, everyone, for being here. And it's a great pleasure. My background, also with PSC Energy for 7.5 years in the natural gas practice, by the end of my tenure, heading the global gas consulting practice and our work around long-term fundamentals. And in that capacity, I've advised companies around the world on natural gas issues, gas markets, as well as gas and LNG projects. So very excited to be bringing that expertise to bear in the case of Alaska. As Senator Giesel mentioned, we have a few slides, but for the most part, what we want to do is give you an initial reaction to the kind of news that has come out, and more importantly, stimulate a little bit of conversation and discussion. So this is not meant to be the final word on these topics. There's, I think most members are appreciating if oil was complicated, oh boy, for gas, a lot more complicated, a lot more issues to discuss. And so we're here to work through them. We have structured this presentation on two specific themes. But before I focus on these two themes, I wanted to sort of step back a little bit and comment on where we are, I think, in the process. And part of the benefit that Janik and I, and maybe a little bit more I, since I've spent a little bit less time in Alaska than Janik, part of the benefit that I feel I have is I have on occasion the ability to look at Alaska from the outside, and so look at the developments here with a little bit of perspective. And I have to say, and this is a message that I reiterated last summer when I was here for the gas symposium, is that at times there seems to have been a lot of very, very different things happening in Alaska when it comes to gas, a lot of different proposals, a lot of different partners, a lot of different plans, a lot of different people. And what I have to say is that the developments over the last month or two are the sort of developments that an analyst like me sitting in Washington, D.C., or sitting in London, sitting in Beijing or Tokyo, it's the kind of developments that people see and they say, oh, wait a minute, something's actually happening. This is not necessarily a comment on the details and the specifics on the fine print of either the MOU or the HOA. This is more a general comment that if I were an analyst in my former job at PFC Energy, trying to understand what's happening in projects around the world, the type of news that's come out of the last couple of months would be news that would catch my attention a lot more than some of the news that has come up, I think, in past times about commercialization of Alaskan gas. So with that as an introduction, we wanted to focus our presentation on two issues. And we've picked those two issues in no other way except that in our conversations, either in person or in our watching of testimony by others and the questions that members of both House and the Senate have posed to the presenters, we've sort of stepped back and said, okay, what are the big questions that people are having? And so we wanted to give you an instinctive reaction, first reaction to those two things. And the two things that we feel have come up more than others are reflected in the title of the presentation. The first is project choices and commitments. And if I can put it very simply, what that means is it's a question of what exactly are we bolting down right now? Clearly, this is a big project with a lot of moving pieces. And what we've heard from a number of members is what exactly are we committing to? We keep referring to LNG being a long-term business with long-term contracts, and a lot of people are wanting to find out, are we making some decisions today that basically commit the state of Alaska to something for 40 years? It's a question that has come in this forum and in a number of other forums. And so what we wanted to talk about is a little bit, how do these projects work? Where are we in the process? How do they evolve? And help you see how we see the type of decision-making and the type of decisions that are likely to take place over the next few months or even over the next year. The second broad area of questions that we've received and we've heard are focused on the midstream. In simple terms, in the parlance of the day, the MOU. Why is the MOU the way it is? Could it be in a different way? How would you structure this? Is the path proposed really the best path? And so we wanted to give you some of our thinking about how we approach that question. Right. So those are the two questions that we chose to focus on in terms of slides. But obviously, there are other questions too, and we'll be happy to talk through them. We only have about 10 or so slides, and so we'll go through them and then you'll get a sense of how we think about these questions. Let me start off.
Thanks, Nikos. Pause one moment. I just want the record to reflect that Senator Bishop joined us a couple minutes ago and Senator Dyson just arrived. Thank you. Go ahead, Nikos.
Thank you for the record, Nikos Tsafos, Analytica. The second slide, and I'll just list the slides for people who are following maybe on the web or later on. This is a slide that we showed last Tuesday in our presentation to LBNA on natural gas market fundamentals. And back then, the slide was called lots of things need to happen in parallel before an LNG project takes off. And we went through upstream, midstream, liquefaction, shipping, marketing. And we wanted to come back to the slide to put a little bit the current decisions and the current announcements in the context of a project. And really, we have put the slightly inelegant orange arrow there, not because we think that SB 138 or even the next 12 months are going to resolve all three of these issues, but to highlight that really the legislation before you, the HOA, the MOU, that's the only part of the project that they even touch. Right? So if you think of a project having these seven different components, really, for the most part, it's focused on the upstream side in terms of fiscal terms for the upstream, midstream in terms of partnership and some basic agreements, and liquefaction, probably less so than maybe the other two, probably in terms of ownership structure and some initial thoughts on how you would structure this project. So We talked ourselves and the administration talked about this process of pre-feed, feed, EPC. The schedule that is put out by the administration seems to us roughly fair, about 12, 18 months for pre-feed. Then you go into a slightly longer feed process, and you don't really get to FID, the final investment decision and construction, until, you know, three, four years from now. And the other part that we highlighted, which we thought was very crucial, and is also reflected in the schedule that you have in front of you, is that really the money gets spent after FID. And the reason this is important is because it's so much money, companies and governments, which are often partners with companies, they don't really want to start spending the real money until they've sorted everything out. And so I think it's important to remember that really the significant increase in capital expenditures, the number that we hear a lot about, the 45 to 65, you won't really see that money getting spent until the latter part of this decade. And the decisions in front of you are really dealing with the first parts of this entire chain. Let me then talk a little bit more about the next slide, slide three. This was also a slide we talked about on the presentation last Tuesday. There is a bit of gray there, which I guess we put a little bit too light gray. Those dark lines actually do point to something. But in some ways, the blank is a good reminder that what we said here is we try to highlight two things, two layers of decision-making. One is you have some gas, whether it's royalty or royalty plus other things. You'll have some gas, and you have to figure out what to do with it, whether take it in value or in kind. And then if you do take it in kind, how to actually market it. What it says there is that you can market it yourself, or you can have someone else market it for you. And when we think about where we are at the process, you really are sort of touching on the first bifurcation there of really talking about value in gas and value versus gas and kind. You really are nowhere near touching anything after that. And so if you think about how far along in the process you are, you really are setting a guide towards probably more in kind in terms of where the intention at least is in terms of taking the gas in kind. But you're not going very far beyond that right now. And the bottom chart, this again comes from our presentation last Tuesday. What we said is when we examined all the LNG projects around the world, and we asked the questions, how do states participate in these LNG projects? What we noticed is that the states were all over the place on this map. And the two axes are, on the y-axis, equity across the chain, so do they have actually any physical ownership of the assets? And then on the x-axis was really how engaged are they in the project? So on the one extreme, you have a state on the bottom left, which is the lower 48, for example, which is purely a tax levying authority and a regulator. The federal government doesn't have any equity in any of the LNG projects. The Louisiana state doesn't have any equity in the LNG projects being built in Louisiana. You just tax and you regulate. On the other extreme, on the top right, you have Algeria as one example, where the National Company of Algeria is 100% equity owner of the upstream, the midstream, the liquefaction, and in fact, Sonatrach, the national company, has some ships as well. And so we said, we thought that a very good conversation for Alaskans is, well, where do you want to be in this world? And the reason we wanted to bring this back here is because it seems to us that there's clearly an intention on the equity side of going up. But really nothing that is in front of you this year settles too much the question of where you end up in this world. You can, as we'll show in the next slide, you can start with equity and then get rid of it. You can start with the intention of being an active marketer and then change your mind. Or you can start with the intention of being a passive marketer and change your mind. There is really nothing right now that locks you in any specific path. And the other thing that I wanted to highlight with this chart here is, and this I think is really important, is to think about these deals as a long-term deal. This isn't really about where the state is going to be today. It's where the state might be over a 40-year period. We've seen, for example, countries that 5-10 years ago were very passive participants in their own LNG projects. But as they developed more experience, as they developed more expertise, as they became comfortable, they said, you know what, I want to take a slightly more active role. I want to market some of my own gas. I don't want to have the companies market the gas for me. And so you really have to think of this in a more dynamic way, because even on both scales, it's where you start isn't necessarily the same place where you end up.
Yes, Senator French.
On this chart, on the lower part of the graph, there's a pair of green arrows pointing to maybe you can just explain a little bit more about what those arrows mean, because in my description, they both point to the same idea, agency marketing or state markets gas, and I can't tell what the difference is and what would return more to the state.
Absolutely. What we wanted to talk about, the purpose of this chart was really to say that if you take your gas in value, you're most likely ending up in the bottom left corner. You're probably not going to be very engaged. You'll sell your gas most likely at the wellhead. You're staying away from equity. The reason we wanted to bring this chart is because we thought there was a tendency, as we kind of read the conversation and what we were hearing, to equate equity with a type of participation. That if you had equity, therefore you had to market your own gas. Or if you had equity, you had to be an active investor. Or if you had equity, you had to go to Tokyo and try to sell your gas. And we wanted to make sure that as you assess this, you really think of equity, which is really the physical ownership of an asset, and level of engagement, which is really to what extent are you managing these assets and managing the share of the state. We wanted to make sure that everyone separates those two things, and that even though there is an assumption that you move across the 45-degree diagonal, that if you have more equity, you have to be more engaged, that's not necessarily true. In fact, you can have a large amount of equity and be a fairly passive investor. Or you can be very active with your share, but not have a lot of equity across the entire chain. What we wanted to make sure is that we don't conflate the issue of equity and say that, well, if you have a 20 or 25% equity, therefore XYZ on the marketing, that's not necessarily true. One doesn't necessarily follow the other. And it's important, as we talk about this, to distinguish between equity and what you do with that equity and how you market potentially your gas.
And is there a, thank you, Madam Chair, is there a significance to one arrow being above the other with respect to agency marketing or state marketing? That is, does one, which is, I guess I don't want to ask which is better, because there's obviously pluses and minuses to both, but in general, which returns more to the state, marketing our own gas or letting someone else do it for us? I mean, that's implied in the choice you offer at the end of these arrows. It says agency marketing or state marketing gas, and I'm just trying to evaluate, you know, what the pluses and minuses are. And maybe it's later in the presentation. If so, I'll wait. But if this is a good time to explain that, please do so.
Through the chair, Nico South, Analytica. The answer sort of depends what kind of deal you get and how, if someone is marketing your gas, are they marketing well, and what are you paying them to market your gas? So I don't think we're quite ready to say one is better or not, and I don't think that until we have specifics of what exactly that deal looks like, we'll be able to answer that. But let me answer the question in a slightly more general way. What we've seen in our experience from LNG projects around the world is that generally states participate in LNG projects through national oil companies. And because, as you know, the LNG business is tends to be slightly more complicated than the oil business in many ways. States tend to start off as slightly more passive participants in projects. And then as they develop their expertise, they take a slightly more active ownership. I was thinking of this in the context of your permanent fund in Alaska, right? Probably when you started off, you were investing it in a different way than you would today. And there's times where you invest directly, and there's times where you hire third-party professionals to invest that for you, to invest the money for you. So I don't think there's a right or wrong way. I think there are trade-offs. But what we wanted to highlight here is two things. First, that there's nothing we think so far that locks you in any specific type of proposition. But the second thing is also to underscore just how dynamically this can change. If I may, let me go to the next slide to flesh this out with a case study to show you exactly what I mean with this idea of dynamic. This is a case study of Queensland Curtis in Australia. This is an LNG project coming from coal bed methane in eastern Australia. Why did we pick this project? Because it made a good, it showed really what we wanted to show in a very nice way. It's not atypical. It summarized pretty nicely what we were trying to get at. So what are we trying to get at with this slide? We try to show you what the project looked like in five key variables at three different snapshots. At the feed process, which is in some ways further ahead than where Alaska is today. At the FID level, which is when the large amount of capital was getting spent. And then today. And I don't want to go through all the details of it, but if you just look on the far left and the far right, I mean, it's hard to imagine that this is actually the same project, right? Much bigger, very different ownership of resources, different ownership of liquefaction, offtake completely different. Started off as a 100% BG group. By January 2014, actually, BG has sold even more than the entire capacity, and they're going to supplement it with other places. External financing from the Japan Bank of International Corporation as well as the U.S. Exim Bank. The ownership of the reserves have changed. CNOOC has come in and taken some big shares. They're actually sourcing gas from another LNG project to supplement their own gas. The reason, and by the way, this project hasn't even come online. My point is that you are right now on the left of that feed. You're even before that point. And the reason we wanted to show you this is to really underscore just how little really is bolted down right now and how much things can change over time. The size of the project changed, the upstream changed. Basically, every single element of these things changed by the time it went to feed and today, which is not even online yet. Right. And this is pretty typical. We're not going to say that every LNG project goes through such a dramatic transformation. But it's actually quite typical for new partners to come in, new contracts to be signed, even after FEED has started and even after FID has been taken. And so we wanted to show this, again, to underscore this tension between, obviously, you have a predisposition, you have a plan, you have what you would like to do, but it's fairly common for these projects to change quite dramatically. And then if we step back and we say, well, in our reading of the MOU and the HOA, there doesn't seem to be too much that really locks you into any specific path on these range of outcomes, and that the type of things that you will have to choose today versus the type of things that you will have to choose over the next 4 or 5 years, the ratio is definitely favored towards the things that we have to decide over the next 4 or 5 years rather than today.
Thank you. Senator Machiki, question?
Thank you, Mr. Safos, right?
Mm-hmm.
You explained things well. I appreciate that very much. And I agree where we are. At least my understanding of the project so far agrees with the way you explained it. What I think is going to be important, although we're not locked in, what I think is going to be important is that the legislature understands the cost of optionality that's in the MOU. And I know we'll have a lot of very specific questions. I think those are the details where the devil lies right now. So would you agree with that?
I would say that if you were to look at what's in front of you, I definitely think that in any LNG project, and this is no exception, you have to look at the fine print and you have to look at the details. And one of the things we underscored in our presentation on Tuesday was the key thing in assessing this is not just to assess it for the purpose of today, but to make sure that you set up a project that can adapt over time, right? So if it's okay with you, let me go to the next section, which is really focused on the MOU.
Okay.
And run you through our thinking. And maybe if at the end of those slides we haven't quite answered your question, we can come back to it. But if you don't mind, we can walk you through our logic of where we've gotten to in the MOU with, again, the understanding that this is a more qualitative first pass and that we're working on the quantitative elements of trying to capture some of these numbers and what they really mean for the state.
Thank you.
Nikos, before you do that, Senator Bishop had a question.
So just briefly for my edification and those maybe that might be watching at home, just give us an example why this project changed so much in 6 years.
Sure. If we just kind of go from the top size, BG, they bought Queensland Gas Company, which is QGC. So they thought they had a little bit less gas at the beginning. They bought them out, and actually they bought a few other companies too. So they were able to prove up and feel more comfortable about the resource, and so they felt more comfortable expanding. The other parts, really, on the upstream liquefaction offtake, the way to think about this is in many LNG projects, and we show there's a good slide we have on this on our market fundamentals presentation. In many LNG projects, there is one of the ways in which you share risk and you sort of share the burden of risk is you have the same partners along the chain. So CNOOC was the anchor buyer. So if you see on the on FID that level, they were taking 3.6 million tons. So they are a Chinese national oil company. They were looking for gas for China. And so they were scouting the world, and they found this project. And they said, we want to take some gas. But we also want to become an investor because there are some returns on the upstream. There are some returns on the liquefaction. But also because it gives you a greater sense of security of supply, especially Asian oil companies and gas companies. They actually measure very carefully how much of their LNG comes from projects that they are owners in. And in fact, the Korea Gas Company, others, they have targets. And they say, we want X percent of our LNG to come from projects that we are equity partners in, because they think of those projects as in a slightly different way, more secure way. So the way to think about this really is you really begin from the last part, the offtake, which is someone wants to come take the gas. And then they're trying to get the two things above it are side deals that come together with the offtake agreement. So I come and take offtake, but I also take a share of the liquefaction. I also take a share of the upstream. And the same can be said for Tokyo Gas. The other thing is, if you look further on between sort of the FID and the January, what really changed was on train one, you can see the ownership structure change. It used to be 90-10, 50-50. And then they brought in, they sold a little bit more gas. The project sold a little bit more gas to CNOOC. And CNOOC also got an option for a third train. So there's a couple of reasons. And again, this is purely my assessment as an analyst. I have no direct knowledge of the company's thinking on this project, but this will be my inference. There were two things probably going on here. One is, everyone wants to partner with Chinese oil companies because that's where the growth is. And so companies tend to find ways to deepen and expand their cooperation with Chinese oil companies. And the second part was that BG had a number of capital commitments around the world, and so they were looking for ways in which they could raise cash, right? So the idea is, in the beginning, when it's a little bit of a riskier project, sometimes you have to take more of the risk yourself. But as you start constructing, people feel more comfortable. You can sell down some of that share to new partners that maybe didn't want to come in 6 months or a year or 2 years ago. So it's mostly about de-risking the project, and it's about reallocating some of that risk. But it's also about connecting the sales and purchase agreements with some burden sharing on the cost structure. And in fact, the CNOOC deal, when they came in and took that 50%, that also included actually a reimbursement for some of the cost that BG had taken up until a certain point. So this was both strategic as well as financial. And that type of deal where you see offtake together with equity, that's fairly common. Again, without any prejudice, I would be surprised if there wasn't an element of that at some point in Alaska. A lot of times these national companies, these buyers, they bring in additional benefits. For example, having a Japanese equity owner usually opens up the project for state-supported financing. The Japan Bank of International Cooperation is one of the largest, probably the largest third-party financier for LNG projects in the world. And they generally tend to give you money if you have a Japanese company, that, because it's the Japanese Bank for International Cooperation. So there are oftentimes considerations like that where you want to bring a partner who also brings in additional benefits besides just their buying power.
Great. Thanks.
Okay. let's switch now a little bit to the MOU and the midstream. And we wanted to start off with basically thinking back and realizing, of course, that there are a large number of ways in which you could think of how to structure a pipeline. And certainly in the experience of both Alaska as well as other states, all sorts of different ways to approach the midstream have been tried. It seemed to us that for the most part where we've ended up is you had three possible options, again, with the caveat that you can play with this more if you would like. You can have a midstream that's struck by the producers. You can have the producers in the state of Alaska, or you can have the producers in the state of Alaska and a third party. And if you were to have that last structure, you could think of either leveraging the AGEA process or terminating the AGEA process and going through a new bid. And so on the chart below, this is essentially the path that's been chosen by the MOU, the things in red. So what we wanted to do is go through each one of these options in a systematic way and talk about what are the pros and cons of each one of them, and how do we think about this in a slightly more systematic way. And before we go through the options, we wanted to basically ask the question, well, what does the state care about? How are we going to evaluate these different permutations and options? And so this is based on it's based on some of the language that's in various documents on commercializing Alaskan gas. It's also based on our slight rephrasing of what we think these interests for the state boil down to. So what we want to do is I'll read through each one of these and explain the rationale, and then I'll hand it over to Janik Meyer so he can run us through how five permutations scores in each one of these variables. Okay, so you want to have alignment. You don't want to be arguing with the producers over where the value is allocated. And you also want tariffs that make sense not just for the pipeline, but for the entire project, upstream, the GDP, as well as the liquefaction. You want to have a project that favors expansions. You don't want to create a project that is purely for the gas that is today in Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. You want to have a project that becomes an enabler for additional investment throughout Alaska. You want gas to be delivered within the state. You want a pipeline that is actually built on time and at the lowest possible cost. And you also want to have some kind of continuity and momentum. Please don't read these as most to least important. They're not meant in anything like that. We were just putting five things out there, and we can be pretty sure that different members, both the House and the Senate, as well as the public, would probably prioritize each one of them in a different way. So we haven't tried to weight these goals. We just wanted to state them. And so with that, let me hand it over to Janik to run us through each of the permutations.
Thank you. For the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. First of all, start off by apologizing to anyone who is solely looking at the screen and does not have a printout in front of them. We clearly either need to have a better contrast on the projector or change the color gray that we use in the text. Perhaps for their benefit, I will go back just two slides to put up on the screen for the moment, the all-in-black version of the sort of decision tree that Nikos stepped through, because I will be stepping through each of these possibilities in terms of what a midstream component that was just held by the producers with no other participants would look like, what one that's the producers plus the state of Alaska might look like, and then producers, state of Alaska, and a third party, both the sort of leverage AGEA and continue down that path with TransCanada, or terminate AGEA and launch new bidding, what each of those options might look like as measured by the sort of five key criteria that Nikos pointed out. So if we think first of all about what a midstream component for this project might look like if it was solely held by the producers with no further involvement. As we look through this, we think about that sort of concept and can immediately identify a series of problems that mean we look at this and think this would be a less than optimal solution. First of all, on the alignment front, overall, and I think we will talk about this in more detail at other times, looking just beyond just the midstream component, I think when we look at the HOA as well as just the MOU and what's been the direction that's sort of the vision that's charted at the moment, I think we would both say that state of Alaska involvement in the whole thing is absolutely key to the question of alignment and the question of how the state of Alaska draws its value from the project versus how the producers draw value and making sure those interests are aligned more broadly. But specifically when it comes to the midstream, there are some challenges involved with the producer-only pipeline, which is particularly that from a producer perspective, if this is one big integrated project, upstream, midstream, liquefaction, and ultimately one big investment that ends up with LNG being delivered into Asia. If that's your commercial approach to the project, you're fairly ambivalent about where in the value chain value accrues. It could accrue at the liquefaction point, it could accrue in the pipeline, though that would be less usual, it could accrue to the upstream. But overall, you view this as one big thing and you view value accruing across the entire chain rather than to one specific place. But if you are, for instance, a third-party shipper of gas who is not a shareholder in all of the parts of the liquefaction chain, if you're the state of Alaska trying to get either its own gas to market or, in particular, trying to get gas to Alaskan residents for domestic consumption, you care a lot about what the pipeline tariff is because the pipeline is a specific component for those purposes. And the higher the tariff, the less you're able to meet some of those key objectives. So if it's only the producers involved in the pipeline, you get a much greater potential for disputes around the question of value and where in the value chain value accrues, what the tariff should be, etc. Whereas when the state is involved as well, that alignment issue starts to be addressed. Similarly, if we think about the question of a third-party expansion and wanting to ensure that there is a very sort of pro-expansion approach to the whole project, as the committee has heard in testimony before, there may be sort of about 35 trillion cubic feet of proved gas on the North Slope at the moment, but there's well over 200, I think close to 250 TCF of believed to be of unproved resource yet to find up there. And so this is constructing this infrastructure is the crucial piece to enabling the broader exploitation of those resources, but it really has to be done with an eye on ensuring that those resources can be exploited and understanding that those resources won't all come from the existing producers. And so ensuring that the infrastructure is open to future expansion, future development is a crucial piece of this. And of course, if it's a producer-only pipeline, there's a very clear interest in that sense in this is an investment that's being done to commercialize existing and future resources that those companies hold, and to get those resources to market for the best price, probably international markets, probably Asia. But there isn't the same overwhelming necessity to say, well, we also make money by shipping other people's gas, because actually these are companies that make money by producing oil and gas and selling the end product, not by shipping it through a pipeline. So there isn't a clear pro-expansion orientation to the project if it's solely a producer project. Similarly, when it comes to in-state deliveries, because of that question of alignment, because of that question of where value accrues across the value chain, it's not necessarily clear what the tariff would be for in-state use, whether that would be optimal or not, etc. These are, when it comes to execution, three very experienced companies with a lot of execution ability, and so on that front, that would tend to meet that objective, a producer pipeline. But again, for these companies, midstream is becoming less and less of a focus. There may well be core capabilities that a pure midstream, pure pipeline company might be able to deliver. Finally, if we think in the context of where we are today, not just in the sort of abstract ideal world of how one might want to lay this out, but in what has actually happened to date, where different parties actually are, it seems to us, with any option that doesn't in some way involve TransCanada specifically as a partner because of the AGEA process, that there is a bunch of work that's been done to date on that front. And any other option, one has to sit down and say, okay, so there are uncertainties about the work that's been done to date, limiting the loss of time and resources, etc., and all of that, and also if those arrangements were not terminated purely through mutual satisfaction, what the liability coming from that would be, and that's obviously a significant question to consider. Moving on to slide 8, to then think about what this would look like if it's the three producers and also the state of Alaska. This probably addresses, as a theoretical formulation, addresses many of the big problems with the previous one. And in particular, you have the much better question of alignment and the state being in there as a partner, being able to ensure that capital structures, everything else about the approach to the whole project is going to be one that ensures the state's objectives as well as producer objectives in terms of, and gets rid of those fundamental questions about where value accrues across the value chain. On the question of third-party expansion, though, it seems to us as we look at this, that there's more of a question on that, because in principle, the state can take an active role as a participant in the midstream and seek to be, to have its role be the vocal pro-expansion voice in this consortium. In theory, there is nothing to prevent that. But the question then becomes one of state capacity and how much experience the state of Alaska has in being a pipeline company. Because ultimately, to have a truly pro-expansion outlook to this project, you want an entity there at the table that isn't just making money by transporting molecules to market and selling the molecules, but that is making money through the transportation process itself, and that actually wants to do business of transportation and wants more molecules to transport, because it's in the transporting that they make money. And unless the state of Alaska can actually go out there and develop all the capability around being a pipeline company and seeking new producers whose gas it can move to market, etc., it's not clear that the state of Alaska by itself has all of the capabilities of an independent pipeline company in terms of both of third-party expansion and, as we'll come to it shortly, on the execution front that a dedicated pipeline company would bring. In terms of in-state deliveries, the state can, of course, use its equity entitled capacity to carry gas to local markets. But on that execution front, again, while you have three producers with strong capabilities in terms of ability to execute on the pipeline front. When it comes to future expansions, it might well be under such a model that it's solely the state of Alaska that's carrying either the future expansion by itself or trying to bring in new partners to carry that expansion. And so the question again comes on that ability to execute front. Does the state of Alaska, as the sort of sole independent and expansion-oriented partner in such a project, have the same capabilities as a third party might, that is a pure midstream company? Finally, the same questions, obviously, that apply to all of the non-leverage AGIA options around possibility of loss of data, of work done to date, of litigation, etc., that needs to be thought through. If we move to the third question of thinking about producers, state of Alaska, and a third party, either, you know, the path of the MOU charts, which is to say the state has a share, it provides that share to the third party, in this case TransCanada, and then has the option to buy back in through an equity option, or any other structure that one could consider. It seems to us, and you know, I think in looking through these options, it took us some time to become truly comfortable with that process, but when we did, we looked through and we could see actually a lot of value on all of these key 5 points. The same value that we've seen before on the on-alignment because of state involvement, but greater value, as I say, when it comes to third-party expansion, because you have a company at the table with a substantial share in this that is not one of not making value by upstream production, not making value by selling molecules in end markets, but solely making its money by the molecules that it transports through the pipe. And the key, its key to increasing its profits being moving more molecules to the pipe and finding more people with molecules to provide that want to move it through the pipe. And it seems to us that is actually a key strength of, in this sense, bringing in a third party, whether it's TransCanada through the AGIA process or any equivalently capable third party, that provides a third party expansion orientation that is definitely to be desired. Similarly, on in-state deliveries, it's a strength of both the pure producers plus state of Alaska, but state of Alaska plus the third party. But again, the question of sort of pro-expansion bias, it seems to us, weighs even more heavily in terms of, again, a pure midstream company making money by moving molecules through the pipe doesn't care whether the molecules are going to Asia or to Fairbanks. It's moving molecules through the pipe and getting its tariff for doing that. And so, again, that counts in terms of in-state deliveries being facilitated as best possible. On execution, specifically in this case on the TransCanada option, TransCanada certainly does bring particular execution know-how and expertise. And it's important to say it's an interesting combination in terms of thinking about both the producers and TransCanada in terms of if one were to look at an option that were just a third party, for instance, running a pipeline, you could say, well, the pipeline business tends to be structured as a sort of regulatory monopoly business, whether it's actually FERC regulated or not. It's a business that says, figure out how much it costs you to build a pipeline, and we'll structure a tariff that lets you recover that over some time period. And the more you spend to build a pipeline, the more the tariff is. So in that sense, as a pure midstream company, you're not terrified as to how much it's going to cost to build the pipeline within reason, because at some point most of that cost can be passed on to end consumers in a higher tariff. Whereas if you're the producer, you really care how much was spent on the project, because you're not making your money by moving molecules through the pipe, you're making your money by selling the molecules to the end market. And the more you spend on the project, the more expensive it is to move those molecules to market. So it's a really interesting combination of having a midstream company that's strongly pro-expansion, but producers that really care about cost control. And to us, it seems to us, particularly when you then combine it with the execution capabilities of both, that actually gets to be quite compelling. Finally, on continuity and momentum, the project then, by choosing that option rather than another third-party option, has the benefit of being able to maintain and accelerate all of the work that's been done to date, as well as the sort of general sense of momentum that I think we would both say we're starting to see, you know, around, you know, our former colleagues, analysts, people in the investment community who for the last 5-10 years have said, oh yeah, Alaska, they keep talking about commercializing their gas, but we'll believe it when we see it, and are finally starting to take notice at the moment and see what's happening, that it maintains a lot of that momentum, as well as not sort of pushing back momentum because of needing to reopen a bidding process, taking another 6 months, a year, 2 years, whatever time process is involved, and possibly sort of stalling HOA negotiations and other things while these key parts are resolved. So those seems to us are the key benefits of that approach. It's worth saying that there is a significant uncertainty though here, which is coming back to that first point on the question of producer State of Alaska alignment. Clearly, one of the overwhelming goals for the State of Alaska is having the lowest possible tariff on the pipeline. And one can look at the terms and the term sheet for the MOU and do any number of comparisons, and we've done quite a bit of that comparison, and if people are interested, we can present some more quantitative analysis of this sort of at a point in the future. But it would seem to us that the capital structure proposed, the cost of equity, the cost of debt, the weighted average cost of capital are all sort of in quite a reasonable comparable range if we look at comparable figures for FERC-regulated interstate pipelines, for instance, in the United States. If we were to include Canada, Canada has a more aggressive regulatory approach to these things. It tends to have a lower cost of capital and lower tariffs. But particularly limiting the analysis to the U.S., it's in the ballpark. But without an open bid process, you never really know what the alternative is. And it could be that out there are other highly capable midstream companies that would put in a more aggressive bid, a more aggressive tariff, and could offer a better deal. It's also quite possible that one could open up the entire process to bidding and take a lot of time to do that, lose a lot of momentum in the process, and find that actually there isn't a better offer, or possibly that the offer we had on the table right now is no longer there and we have a worse offer. Those are the uncertainties that one can't ever truly know. One can only make a decision with the best available information in a time of uncertainty as to what seems the most reasonable course of action, because each pathway closes off the other to some extent.
Good question. Question, Senator Machiki?
Yeah, and I mean, I reviewed this coming up and didn't see, and I know you talked about it a little bit earlier, but if you were to prioritize these five areas of importance, would that have been helpful? Typically, that's something, if you were making this decision yourselves, you would have a list of priorities, and these might be 1 through 5. Comments?
Senator Machiki through the chair. I think my first response would be to say that's as much a question for individual legislators and policy objective as it is. We're here to try to walk you through the issues as much as possible rather than to make value judgments which may be different for different legislators. I look at these and I'm hard-pressed to pick ones that I would substantially demote over the others. It seems to me these are all fairly core priorities for the state of Alaska. And the question of how one balances, for instance, continuity and momentum against lowest possible tariff and the uncertainty that exists around lowest possible tariff and whether one might get a better deal or might not get a better deal, I think is something that individual legislators need to grapple with, not something that I can provide a firm answer to. I don't know if my colleague Nikos has a further comment.
All right, go forward. Thank you.
Finally, if we come to the last option, that which is to say one decides that producers plus the state of Alaska and also a third party is the best approach, but comes to the alternative conclusion, which is to say, well, rather than leveraging what's been done for AGEA, we'd like to terminate that and launch a new bidding process. You see, so something that is similar in its strengths on many of the key aspects. But the question on alignment is one of, well, a new bid could lead to a new, better, lower tariff, but it could also lead to one that's no better. It could even lead to one that's not as desirable as the one that's being considered at the moment. And then the question of, does, for instance, if we look back at the AGEA process, the number of bidders that were involved then, do we think there's going to be an overwhelming number of bidders in this process? If there aren't, does that slow down the whole process as we try to make sure that we have a truly competitive bid process, et cetera? What does that do to the entire situation? And finally, I think the biggest difference in this scenario versus the previous is, again, that question of continuity and momentum, and what data, what work done to date can be ensured is kept, what's the cost to the state in terms of litigation and all of the rest. So, to conclude, on slide 11, it seems to us that there are then some sort of key questions that the state needs to weigh in looking at the MOU as to where its interests are. What compensation might the state have to pay in order to get out of the AGEA license if it wants to do that? What intellectual property would Alaska LNG retain of work that's been done to date? What would happen to the HOA process if the midstream were uncertain in various ways, either because of a bid process, because there was litigation involved? How would all of that play out? What would that mean for the momentum that's thus far all of the other elements of the chain have? What does one think are the odds that a bidding process would open up better terms than are currently on the table? And in particular, if one looks back at the history of when there has been an open offer on bids for not completely dissimilar projects, how many bidders have been involved, how competitive have they been, what does one think the chances are of a more competitive offer coming up? And perhaps one's view of that is coloured by looking back at the AGEA process, for instance, and the number of bidders and the degree of competition in that. And does one think that was representative of what would happen today, or are there ways of ensuring a more competitive process with more serious, credible bidders in involved? And finally, if one thinks that it might be possible to get a better tariff, for instance, through a competitive deal, would that offset the whole question of absence of a dedicated pro-expansion party in the midstream from the negotiating table as other key contractual aspects of the project are being nailed down? And would that be worth the reduced momentum, etc., litigation, all the rest? So it seems to us those are the key things that need to be balanced in trying to decide whether this is a good approach to take or not. That includes our testimony today, and we're happy to take questions.
Okay, great. Senator French?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Going to equity participation, how much do I have to participate in order to get alignment? Do I have to have 1%? Do I have to have 51%? Tell me how much I need to risk to get alignment.
You guys want to take that one?
Through the chair, Nikos Office Analytica. If you consider alignment as, if you consider equity as only valuable for the purpose of alignment, right, I'm not sure that there's a clear answer to that question, right? In part because you kind of have to ask yourself, well, what is alignment, right? If alignment is meant to say we're in this together, we are a serious player, we're willing to see this through by putting some of our own money on the table and willing to demonstrate our commitment to the partners and the world and the buyers and the bankers. If that's what alignment is, to kind of get everyone a little bit more excited about the project and create momentum, I don't know what the magic number is, but my gut feeling would be 1% wouldn't quite cut it. But my sense would be that if you try to figure out how much do you need, how much equity should you take, it's hard to answer that question if you just look at it purely as an alignment process as opposed to value creation, unlocking the project, carrying potentially the state's gas to local markets. I mean, if you go with that process, if you had 1%, you probably wouldn't get that as far as you would like, probably on in-state deliveries. And I think the other part, where again I'm trying to work through this question, is you may, because you kind of asked two things. You said what's the equity, and then how much do you have to put on the, how much do you have to risk? I would take you back to our previous statement on the dynamic elements to that. You might actually be able to get alignment by having a 20 or 25% equity share today, but you might not have to risk 20, 25% of the entire capital of this project through the process, because you can start off, and then as the project gains momentum, you could sell that down without risking that either alignment or the momentum of the project. I'm not sure that this answers your question fully, but I'm also not sure that if you only look at it through that prism, you can come up with a good answer to that. I think you have to think of equity as serving multiple purposes, not just alignment. There's definitely a case that says one is better than zero because it brings you to the table. I would assume that 51 is probably too much in sense of being a majority owner in a project. But there's also states that do that have a 51% equity stake in projects. So there's nothing unprecedented about it. But my sense would be that the answer depends on something that's a lot more than just alignment. It has to do with your view of the state, your willingness to invest, to take different kind of risk for different kind of rewards, rather than just bringing together different parties, if that's what we mean by alignment.
Through the chair, I might add to that, if I could.
Yes.
For the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. It's as part of that alignment question, it seems to me one of the questions is about how do companies generate value from this project, and how does the state generate value from the project? So there are numerous questions of alignment, and some of those, as my colleague Nikos says, are addressed potentially by having a relatively small and symbolic share to show commitment, skin in the game, etc. Others, it seems to me, require a substantially bigger share in an ideal world, because they're about saying we are trying to align our interests so that we all get value in roughly the same way from the project, so that instead of the companies get it by selling gas into Asia, we get it by taxing the companies, and so the more we can tax them, the better we do, but the worse they do, and that tug of war, instead saying, well, we're all in this together. We have a share of this that we think is our right because it's our resource, and if we look back at the tax structure, etc., this is roughly what we think that share comes to. But we're going to take it the same way that you do, both because when we look at the way that you, the companies, do your economics, we think that this makes it a much more compelling case if we do that, and it makes a much more competitive project if we do that, but also because it means we really are all in this together and we're all getting our value in the same way, and what helps any of us helps all of us, and what hurts any of us hurts all of us. And to that extent, the overall end point that is at least envisioned in the HOA, though, as Nico says, nothing is bolted down and everything is up for negotiation, but the sort of envisionment of at least an initial structure of a state share of gas of 20 to 25% and a corresponding equity stake has a certain compelling logic to it in that sense, in terms of the degree of alignment that it creates, that it seems to me other approaches would not would not create. That's not even necessarily to say that the state, that therefore, if the state were to take that approach, that's the only way of the state getting value out of the project, because the state could set up that infrastructure initially and then say, okay, look, we've shepherded this project through to construction, it's being built, it's a real project, everyone understands that. We would actually like to sell down half of that share, and what we're effectively doing in the process of selling down is simply monetizing the future revenue stream of all of the LNG for the next 20, 30 years and its future value and bringing that to the present. And doing whatever we want with that money rather than taking it in deferred payments over time. So there are still a lot of different ways of doing that, but it seems to me the overall structure that's envisioned by the HOA has particular benefits in terms of alignment that go beyond just the sort of we have some skin in the game that a smaller stake might entail.
Good. Follow-up, Senator French?
Yeah, this is actually on a different topic, and so if the committee, I'll let, you know, the committee decide if we want to move on to this or something else, but I guess I'm starting to wonder about some of your economic analysis about the downside. I mean, basically, I'm giving up the power to tax this project in exchange for a piece of it in order to make it happen, and this piece should pay me the same as the taxation. I'll get, you know, this piece is an equity share, and I'll make money the way an owner would. I give up taxation, I get equity, I get some ownership, and it should be roughly the same. In fact, it should be higher, really, because this is more risky. But in order, you know, there's an iron law in finance. You know what it is. I know what it is, which is the greater risk, the greater the downside. The greater the return, the greater the downside. There's no getting away from that. If there was an easy way to make money, we all would be doing that right now, not this. But the fact is, there's not an easy way, because the more risk, you know, the bigger the return, the bigger the risk. So if you haven't begun to analyze the downside of this, I'm certainly interested in it. You know, what could go wrong? You know, how big of a commitment could the state be asked to make in mid-project, and so forth?
Through the chair, Nico Salfis, Senator French, I think that's a great question to ask, and I want to answer it in a qualitative way, and then we're going through the numbers as we speak. Some of this was in the presentation we did on Tuesday, and we wanted to sort of capture the range, and so let me just spell out the risks, and then with the understanding that we're trying to quantify them. Before the project starts, before the first cargo leaves the port, you really have two fundamental risks: delays and cost overruns. We did a survey of most of the LNG projects that have come online over the last decade. You saw a range of anywhere from 6 to 9 months early to two and a half years late. That gives you a sense of the type of delay that you can expect. And cost overruns that are some of them on budget, although you don't see quite as many of those anymore, sadly, and cost overruns in the range of 20, 30, 40%. And I think the reason you have publicly quoted a range of 45 to 65 is because if they came out and said 45 and it turned out being 65, you would treat that as a cost overrun. But if you say 45 to 65 and you're up at 65, you end up on the higher end of the estimate. So you're also seeing, I think, the caution that companies have recognized going through these big LNG plants, and actually big oil and gas projects in general, the uncertainty of the construction cost. So that's before the first cargo ships. After that, there are a number of risks that you can face. There are risks of lower utilization. We look historically at the projects. They tend to operate at 85, 90% of their nameplate capacity. So your nameplate is 15 to 18 million tons, the range being due to weather. So one of the risks could be that at any given time, you may be at 85 or 90%, and you might even have years where you're at 60 or 70% if something happens and you just have to shut down the plant or shut down some of the upstream. So we'll work to quantify that. Other risks are probably less relevant for the case of Alaska. Domestic gas diversion happens in a lot of places where powerful constituencies ask for gas, and that's diverted from the export market. My sense is that Alaska would be hard-pressed to find as much demand that there isn't gas to feed the LNG market anytime soon. And the other risk that you face is really a market risk. And in the past, the market risk could manifest itself by the inability to produce. We showed the case of Sonatrach, the Algerian oil company, in the 80s and early 90s. They were targeting the U.S. market. The U.S. market didn't need any LNG, so they were producing less. In the case of Qatar, in today's world, they're faced with a similar environment. They were targeting the U.S. The U.S. doesn't need the gas, but they're still able to send it to the U.S., and they just get a lower price. So the risk is not necessarily an inability to produce, but an ability to get a lower price. The two things I would add to close this, in general, and I say this with a certain amount of caution, in general, LNG projects don't, quote-unquote, lose money. They may be suboptimal investments. Because once you put the infrastructure in, the cash generated is generally much, much higher than your operating costs. Right? So it's hard to be cash negative at any given time. Now, whether when you look back 10 years ago you would have still made that decision, that's a whole other question. And that's what I mean by suboptimal. You may decide that you didn't invest your capital wisely, but for the most part your exposure is until the project comes online. Even in projects that have experienced severe cost overruns, the impact is really a lower return on investment rather than being cash negative. The last thing I wanted to talk about, and I think it's also important in contrast to taxation, is there are a number of commercial arrangements in which you can limit your exposure. One of the things we talked about was S-curves. So S-curves essentially mean that imagine the price of gas, as it is in Asia, is linked to the price of oil. So S-curve, what it does, it says, well, the price of gas is linked to the price of oil, but if you get above a certain point, you won't keep increasing the price of gas in the same way. And in order to do that, we also, on the downside, offer some protection. So in a way, you can think of this as when you think about your investment portfolio, you would think of having a little bit of bonds, having some equities, and maybe having some emerging market equities in there as well, and different range of risks. You can do something pretty similar for the LNG project too. You can think of it as, you know, we have state of Alaska 20-25% of 15 to 18 million tons. We can think of having some of that gas. Doesn't take a lot of upside, but we're well protected on the downside, so we have at least some revenue that's coming in. We have a second stream of gas that has a little bit more risk exposure, and then we can say there's 10 or 20% that is fully market dependent, and if the market is great, we'll make a killing. If the market tanks, we'll absorb that cost. For sure, there's nothing in front of you today that precludes you from picking that investment philosophy. And in fact, you can change that investment philosophy over time. BG, which is the company we talked about in the Queensland Curtis project, you know, there was a time back in 2008 where almost all their LNG was marketed in the spot market. They loved the spot market. They were getting very great returns. And then they realized that actually the market was changing. So they went and they locked all this gas down into short and medium-term contracts. So there's nothing that prevents you from adapting to the circumstances. But there are a number of contractual ways, especially if you're willing to forgo some upside, to protect yourselves pretty well on the downside. Most LNG projects have state partners, and states like some kind of predictability. And there are a number of contractual ways in which you can protect yourself to get the type of predictability that you desire, without necessarily foregoing all of the upside. But you probably have to forego a little bit of upside because there's no free lunch.
I might add one thing to that if I could. For the record, Janik Meyer, Analytica. Through the chair, Senator French, you started off the question referring to risk and reward, and I think that's a really important framework to have in thinking about this, and I think it applies in a number of ways. Nikos has talked about the risk side of that equation, but I think it's also important to think in some ways about the reward side of the equation and whether one is commensurate to the other or not. And in those terms, you asked about the question of, well, we'd be taking an equivalent share of gas to the cash that we might otherwise have had through the tax system, et cetera. But the important thing to think about is where in the overall value chain you maintain ownership of that gas until. And again, there are a lot of options open to the state under the sort of path of the HOA, right? It could, if it doesn't come up with successful negotiations around gas in kind, say, look, we give up, we're going to take it in value at the wellhead. It could say, no, we're going to take it in kind, but we then have various options. We could take it in kind and then say, well, we don't really want the risk exposure of being an LNG producer marketing gas to Asia. We actually want to negotiate to sell the gas at that point back to producers for some negotiated price rather than just the sort of net back to the wellhead. We could say we're going to ship it through the pipeline and make LNG out of it, but we really don't want to go through all of the expense and difficulty of finding out what's involved in building an LNG marketing operation, and we think that that's not where, that we don't really have those capabilities and that we're very difficult to do competently. And so we want to contract out to different parties to sell our LNG. Maybe we will have some bids from the three producers. Maybe we'll ask other companies with big LNG trading portfolios, a Shell, a BG, someone else, to come and give us offers on what they would charge us to be our agent to market our gas. And maybe, as Nikos says, over time, that's going to change. We start off with three people, companies with a lot of experience marketing our gas, and at some point we say, you know, we don't think we're getting the best deal we could. We think we've got enough confidence in this that we really could build up our own marketing operation here, and we're going to start marketing some of our gas ourselves, as in fact Trinidad did in subsequent trains of Atlantic LNG. So there are a lot of options around that. But the key thing to remember is that where you participate in that value chain certainly shapes the risk that you take, but it dramatically shapes the reward that comes from that as well. Because, for instance, Nikos has a number of times now given the example of Equatorial Guinea LNG, where I think, you know, Nikos can correct me if I'm wrong on the numbers, but I think upstream resource holder gets about 25 cents per 1,000 cubic feet of gas. The LNG producer makes LNG and it leaves the plant for $2.85, and then that gas is sold into Japan for $14, $15, $18 per MMBTU. So there's enormous variation in the value of gas, and having 25% of a resource in that sense of the wellhead is very, very, very different to having 25% of a resource landed into Japan. Mm-hmm. And there is both on the risk front and on the reward front.
Other questions?
One,
Senator Machuki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you talked about kind of the biggest risks. I think in our case, we don't have two companies. We have a company and a sovereign. Our biggest risk is probably inadequately understanding the impacts of an agreement, which we I hope we certainly take our time to understand those impacts. But so if you go to the slide, the last slide that has a comparison. There you go. And we have some assumptions in there. If you moved a couple of levers and your assumption is that the state had no additional burden or liability under the AGIA agreement, what would change on your producer state alignment and your continuity and alignment on this slide?
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, I think it would primarily be a question then, if one were to simply isolate that and say that doesn't apply for whatever reason, it then becomes simply a question of how one trades off the possibility, though by no means the certainty, of a different or better tariff through a competitive process, and whether one thinks that's likely or not, and how much better that might be or not, versus the question of both momentum and also having a pure midstream company that makes its money by moving gas through the pipeline at the table over the next 6, 12, 18 months at a time that particular commercial agreements are being signed. That it seems to me is the trade-off then.
So,
did you have a follow-up, Senator Machiki?
I do. I mean, you'd have to fork that second choice. You might still have a third party. What's that?
But it would take... Through the chair, Senator Machiki, it would take some time for that third party to come to the table, and if either what that means is that there is a delay of 6, 12, 18, 24 months in that process, and other parts envisioned by the HOA take longer, or those parts are able to move in tandem, but they're moving with only the state of Alaska and without that third party at the table.
Mm-hmm. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, ma'am. This is for either one of you, and if you can't answer it, if you could just get back with me on it, I'd appreciate it. Who has the best track record globally on marketing gas?
For the chair, Nikos Tsafos, Analytica. The reason I'm not quite sure is goes to the question of really best, right? And really sort of like saying who has the best investment strategy. Well, in any given year, you can really make a killing. But you have to step back and look at it over a long period of time. If I abstract a little bit of that and you say, well, what is the best marketing strategy? Let's think this through. You would probably say, you know, it's a good price. Right? Having a high price for your gas is an indication of a good marketing strategy. We showed last week a curve for Qatari deliveries in different markets, and the Qataris have on one extreme some $20 gas that's going to China. I would say they were very lucky when they signed that deal. It was a great deal. And they also have some $2.50, $3 gas that's coming to the United States. So if you only look at the China contract, you can say that was a great deal. If you look at the portfolio, it has a range of pricing. So I would say if you were to abstract a little bit more on that and say, who out there tends to sign good deals on LNG? Sometimes companies sign what you can call bad deals because the timing is bad. If you're trying to sell LNG when everyone wants LNG, you can get a good deal. If you're trying to sell LNG when no one wants to sell LNG, you get a bad deal. I don't think that there is any one company that has any particular that stands out. I think there's probably seven or eight companies that I would think of as extremely competent LNG marketers that can get sustainably good value for their gas. But even they sometimes sign deals that they regret in retrospect because the time that they signed them, the market conditions were such and they changed. So I don't think it's a very... Let me rephrase it. If you were to go say, I am the state of Alaska, I have gas, who wants to market this on my behalf? I think quite a lot of people are going to knock on your doors, and I think you'll probably get a number of fairly good offers. It's not going to be either A or B. I think it's going to go all the way down to, you know, K, L, N, O, P, in terms of the possibility of options. And you'll find that there isn't a step change between the best and the next. I don't think that fully answers your question because I didn't give you the name of a company, but I think it really does reflect the reality of the market that there's just a good number of companies out there that know how to do this really well. The value of the gas in the largest in most cases really comes from the time that you signed it. If you had just a good market, tight market, you got a good price, rather than who signed it.
Other questions? Oh, Senator Fairclough.
Madam Chair, I can hold till a later date, but it seems to me that we receive information from experts from around the globe, and we listen to things that have happened around the world, but it seems to me that we have to agree at some point as a group, either in the Resource Committee or on the Senate floor, on what we're being told are the variables inside the project. And so when I look forward to the conversation where we talk about continuity and momentum, because it seems like we can't even go through the gate if we don't agree that to protect the molecules that we might want some expertise in that with us. And so it seems like a gate that we have to go through and develop some confidence both for Alaskans and for the committees as we go forward with that. And it seems to me on execution, it's another gate. It's an opportunity to learn more and exchange ideas on why that is a good or a bad idea for the state of Alaska. And so I'm sorry to take up time right now, but it seems like we should be looking, I guess we need to first, do we really agree that these five ideas encapsulate all of the different opinions on what's most important for Alaska in considering to move forward with a huge investment that has potential risk and potential upside for the people of Alaska? And I think today's presentation has appropriately laid the risk and reward out to some degree, and we'll look forward to more of the financial models to talk about those. But I don't know, maybe others think it's a foregone conclusion that TransCanada should be part of the mix. I'm just wondering whether we should have that debate in public on the record so that we decide whether it's TransCanada or another pipeline company and talk about those risks. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, gentlemen, following up on that theme, we did have that that bid process several years ago for AGEA. And if I'm not mistaken, there were only three interested parties, TransCanada being one, a Chinese company, another, and I can't recall who the third was.
Out of Valdez, Madam Chair.
Through the chair, I think we looked at that. I think there were four parties, and TransCanada was, I believe was the fifth. And our understanding was that at the end of the day, the TransCanada application was the only one that got a measure of completeness. That was at least our understanding of the process.
So with your knowledge of who those other companies were, and supposing they were to raise their hands again and say they were interested in this, perhaps similar to Senator Bishop's question, is there a best company in the world who builds pipelines in Arctic conditions across mountain ranges and comes in on time and on budget?
For the chair, to both of Nikos Tsavos and Analytica, part of the answer is really lack of comparable data points. Not a lot of people have built 800-mile pipelines across similar territory. Sakhalin in Russia, Shell built, I think it was a 500-mile pipeline. The Sakhalin project is also one that you'll see stands out in our table of cost overruns. They had a number of challenges there, nothing to do with Shell in particular, just it was a very difficult project. But let me abstract a little bit more generally. The company that Janik and I used to work for, PFC Energy, now IHS, every year it puts out a document called the PFC Energy, now the IHS Energy 50. And it's a list of the 50 largest publicly traded companies in the world. And they also do a segmentation for each of the aspects of the oil and gas business, exploration, production, refining. So we went and we looked at the segment called midstream infrastructure. And the TransCanada, I believe, was fourth. It measures them through a market cap at the end of last year. There was one company at the top at about $60 billion. Market cap, and then there were three companies below at the $30 to $40 billion market cap. And so if you looked at it and you said, well, who are the big pipeline midstream companies out there, TransCanada is definitely on a list of, you know, the top five if you were to count it by market cap, and obviously there are a number of other ways to count it. If you looked at the entire list, the top 15 companies, at least as I looked at it, I didn't really see any company that instantly popped in my head as having shown an interest in building a pipeline in Alaska. I could be wrong. Don't take it as a definitive statement. I am becoming aware every day that there's more history to Alaskan oil and gas than I know. So at some point, some of these companies may have approached in different ways, but not in an obvious public way. So I think that the question of are there other pipeline companies that are of the size and have expertise, absolutely. Have they shown an interest in Alaska? I'm not sure, at least not to my knowledge. Why is that? I wouldn't dare speak on their behalf. But I can say that in general, companies look at you know, risk reward, likely completion, and this could look like a fairly tough pipeline to build. And so you have to be really convinced of the reward to take the risk. So all these things, I think, are fairly they point definitely in the direction of when you sit back and you say, if you were to go to a bid process, what would you get? The answer is obviously I don't know, and if you don't do a bid, you will never know. But if you do look at the past, it doesn't seem that the other big names on that list of the top publicly traded pipeline companies, I at least haven't heard them as much associated with Alaska in the past, and I'm not quite sure why that is. It could be lack of my own knowledge, or it could be that they've decided this isn't a strategic place for them to come invest. I realize that the question of TransCanada has a number of dimensions to them. You know, listening to just presentations of the last week, questions about their investments in Canada and how maybe a company like TransCanada would prioritize the U.S. versus Canada or Alaska versus Canada. In general, as Janik alluded to, the allowed return on equity tends to be higher in the U.S. than on average in Canada, but also, you know, the way we see it, a company like TransCanada makes its money by transporting molecules. The more molecules they can transport, the better it is, whether they're in Canada or the U.S. So there are a number of them. I just realize we're only capturing a few of them. But in the question, I think, for at the end of the day, as Janik said, you look at this slide, the ultimate issue is, you know, are you going to go through a process to get a better deal than what you have now, given the cost of not having some of the negotiating table, not having the same momentum and the costs? I would say that obviously it's speculative. I don't know the answer to that question, and maybe we can't know. But I think to answer that, you really have to go to the previous question and say, well, to what extent was the GIA process representative? And that's something that, you know, individual people can have their own views. To what extent did that really reflect the industry's interest in building a pipeline across Alaska? Because if it did, that gives you a certain amount of answer to the question of who will come again. But if for some reason you say, well, that was a different project, and that was, you know, a few years ago, and so maybe people are interested now, that'll give you a different answer. But it's hard to know, and you won't know for certain the answer to that question.
Senator Machicki?
I think a couple things are sort of important to clarify. I mean, TransCanada is an incredible company. I have no negative things about TransCanada, but for an apples to apples, TransCanada's experience on a pipeline of this diameter, of this pressure, is non-existent. Is that correct? 48 inch, 2200 psi, and that's just to my knowledge, that's a relatively specialized expertise. So I'll get to a question, I promise. So
I just ask you to clarify, did you say TransCanada did not have that experience? I didn't quite understand what you'd said.
That's, I am unaware of a experience in a pipeline of that size and that pressure. And I don't know if you know that, so I'm not going to pin you down. It's something for us to look into. On execution, their record is incredible. Lots of folks design, construct, and operate pipelines, but TransCanada is not an EPC. They have someone that designs and constructs pipelines for TC. They may manage the project. That's another assumption I think we need to look at. Their experience on the full gamut of pipeline projects. And I think it's fair to say that things have changed since the GIA in the world of large diameter pipelines associated with LNG projects. And that's the one question I'll ask you to answer. Would you agree that of the last 10 large scale projects, that there are new entrants into this area of expertise, that if it weren't for a GIA, we might be looking at those
as competitors.
If you focus this on, through the chair, Nico Staffos, for the record, if you ask, you know, what kind of pipelines are built for LNG projects, there are definitely some projects out there that have really large pipelines associated with them. Over the last few years, 4 or 5, you also had some really large-scale pipelines in Russia built to commercialize gas in the Yamal Peninsula. In terms of, if you really focus on comparability, not just of diameter, but really of terrain and everything else, I can't think of an LNG project that would be that has an infrastructure that's under construction that's comparable to what might happen in Alaska, with the exception probably of the Sakhalin project in Russia. There are a lot of pipelines getting built for LNG projects right now. A lot of them are in Australia, fairly different climate. Has there been progress in terms of the ability to construct pipelines and build pipelines? Absolutely. To what extent will that translate into increased interest in Alaska? I don't know. But especially if your question is specifically on big pipelines in this terrain for an LNG project, I think it's a pretty short list of who's really done that. And that's primarily because you actually don't have that many LNG projects. Shnovit is in Norway. It's an offshore field, so it's really an offshore pipeline, much shorter. I would venture, I think it's in the 100-something miles, but I could be wrong in that number. Nothing like what you have here. So there's definitely technical advancements. How they would translate into company interest in building a pipeline in Alaska, I can't speak to. But it's also not the number of projects out there is not too high, I think, of people that have done that. At least that would be my, off the top of my head, that would be my impression, knowing the LNG projects out there.
Thank you.
All right. Very good. Gentlemen, thank you. We will, of course, be having you back with more specific questions in the future, but I appreciate your presentation today. We're going to take a brief at ease because we're going to transition now to another speaker, and we'll be talking about the Alaska LNG project. So we'll take a short brief at ease here. All right, I'm calling Senate Resources back to order after a brief at ease. And we are now going to hear from Mr. Steve Butt, who is the project manager for the Alaska LNG project. You are going to help us review what that project is, Mr. Butt. So welcome. Please introduce yourself and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As you said, my name is Steve Butt. I had my first introduction to the Alaskan gas business in 1984 when I worked briefly for Sohio on Muckluk. Since then, I've got about 30 years of project experience, primarily in the U.S. I went to Venezuela in 97 as the operations manager. I went to Equatorial Guinea in 99 where we built significant infrastructure in Equatorial Guinea, some of which you were talking about. Spent some time in Angola, Nigeria, in Cameroon, 8 years in West Africa, and then I went to Qatar, where for over 4 years, I was the production vice president responsible for bringing on stream 4 of the world's largest LNG trains and operating as general manager of the world's largest gas plant. So I have a little bit of experience on LNG and projects, and I was lucky enough to come back to the U.S. a couple years ago and start working with a great group of people, some of whom are in this room, representing BP, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and TransCanada in a project that we now call Alaska LNG, where our goal is to figure out the best way to commercialize North Slope gas resources through the use of the LNG process. Some of you folks have seen this presentation, so I'll try and go through it really quickly and make as much time for questions, but please ask questions along the way. If I leave something out, just, you know, I'm happy to stop and talk. I much prefer a dialogue, so I'll try and limit any monologue here. Before I jump to the next slide, I just want to put one idea as background. Through the last couple years of working with our project team, I used kind of three ideas to test what we're doing. Alignment, risk reduction, and cost reduction. And I kind of call those three phrases the arc of success. Alignment, risk reduction, and cost reduction. And some of the folks I've met with earlier, I've used this phrase, and forgive me, I abuse this phrase, because it's the most important principle and framework to think about the project. Success in this project comes from maximizing alignment. We have a unique opportunity here where all the resource owners, all the principal resource owners in Alaska, including the state, are trying to come together to put this forward. That is a level of alignment that's never been achieved, and that's really powerful. We still have a lot of risks. We have a regulatory framework that's never been tested on a project this large. We have a market that's never been tested on this project. We have a high level of uncertainty around costs and other issues that I know you all are aware of. But my job is to work with the team to try and drive those risks down and make sure we understand uncertainty. Understand the uncertainties and mitigate them is our challenge. And by working together in an aligned fashion to reduce risks, it's all about reducing cost. Cost of supply is the guiding metric we use to decide if a project can really survive, if it's viable. Gas is a commodity. Buyers want a cheap commodity that they can trust because they're going to put their entire economy at risk to the LNG that they buy. Their children and their grandchildren are going to use that LNG over long-term contracts, and they want to know that the project's going to deliver LNG to their doorstep every 2 days, every 3 days, for the next 35 years. That's a huge commitment, but it all comes down to their confidence in the project. Have we reduced the risks? Have we built enough alignment that we can deliver at low enough costs that as markets go up and down, we can win? So as I flip through these slides, I'd invite you to kind of test me against those three concepts, alignment, risk reduction, and cost of supply, because those three ideas kind of define the arc of success. So let's start with a little overview on the project. We've had some really significant accomplishments we're proud of. We've come together, we've got an integrated design, we know where we would treat the gas, how we would transport the gas, how we would liquefy it. I'll talk a little bit about that. We've been working with the Nikiski Industrial Area as our lead site for several months. We were in Kenai last week. We've made a lot of progress on that. The area has been very welcoming to us. It's got a long history of LNG manufacturing in this state, and it looks like a great place for us to work. We're getting good reception with the landowners, and that's very important because to go to the DOE and get an export permit, we have to demonstrate that we have the land that we need to build the plant. So it's a critical uncertainty that we're working right now, and once we get that resolved, we can move to the next uncertainty on permitting. We moved forward on our summer field season. We're able to get some information north of Livengood for permitting. That really helps us. We've confirmed our ability to integrate into Prudhoe Bay. And I want to talk a little bit more about that on the next slide, but that ability to integrate differentiates this project from previous projects that worked gas in Alaska. This project is not a pipeline project, so some of the FERC regulatory firewalls required in a pipeline don't apply here. Phrases like open season are really misnomers. They don't apply in this project, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And most importantly, we've got some great progress on the GTP. I'm looking forward to showing you. We've figured out sea lifts and logistics. A project this big is all about managing those issues, all those little tiny things that drive the big costs. If you get them all right, then you can deliver in a low-cost manner. I'm pleased to say that in Qatar, all those trains were delivered on or ahead of schedule, on or ahead of budget. And, you know, the companies involved in this project have a long history of successfully developing LNG. So when you look at LNG and you look at who's doing what, it's important to understand, you know, who's helping drive the decisions and are they working in a manner that's going to be successful. There's huge benefits to this project to the state. I think folks know we're talking about a $45 to $65 billion investment in Alaska. Those are enormous numbers. Those create tremendous quantities of jobs, 9 to 15,000 jobs for construction, another 1,000 jobs for the long term. And when I talk about 1,000 jobs in the long term, it's important to remember job multipliers. The oil and gas industry creates a lot of other jobs besides the operating jobs. Those 1,000 folks need to eat. They need places to stay. They need to buy lunch. All those jobs help create other jobs, and sometimes folks use multipliers on the order of 7 to 9 for the oil and gas industry, but that 1,000 jobs is just the tip of the iceberg. More importantly, the LNG project does something that's kind of unique. It generates revenue for the state. As it's designed with the state as a participant, the state has the opportunity to take its share of the revenue commensurate with its share of the investment, and that creates alignment. So if we get back to those three ideas, that alignment helps create revenue so that over decades as we come forward, there's revenue to the state. And I know you guys have seen numbers from Black and Veatch, but there's some significant numbers that I'll leave to them. Also, this gas provides natural gas for Alaskans. By building this pipeline, you can source gas to folks in the interior. I've had the opportunity to be in Fairbanks several times. I was there a couple weeks ago in the welding center and talk to folks about the importance of getting gas in the interior, and you can feel their passion on it, and this project can meet that. We've also had a really good start on our safety, health, and environment work. We executed all our work in the 2013 summer field season incident-free. We were really pleased with that. We had about 150 people in the field. They worked almost 100,000 hours. No incidents. We had some near misses and some challenges that we've learned from. We feel pretty good about it. We were able to measure and quantify the systems. I've got a couple pictures here of some of the work they did, but in the interest of time, I'll kind of leave it that what they do is they understand every ecosystem or environment we touch so that in the event the project is built, we can ensure there's no damage. Some of our big challenges are going to be around how we manage the mega project aspects of it. Of this animal. Mega projects are often defined as any project over $1 billion. In today's world, sometimes they're defined as a project over $10 billion. By any metric, this is, you know, one of the largest mega projects ever, and in some ways it's really 5 mega projects, each one working with each other. It's so big it creates its own weather, and if we're not careful, it competes with itself, because you don't want to have challenges with welders on Part A working at odds or at issues with Part B. So we have to plan this very carefully so that we level load the work and we make sure we can get the resources we need with the right craft skills, and we don't compete with ourselves. That's very important. We also have to make sure we look through some complex commercial arrangements so that we get the right framework in place and we can deliver the gas, minimize any socioeconomic impacts. So we had a couple great discussions with the folks in Kenai last week, and I've opened a little office there to try and understand that and make sure that we are a good member of that community as the project moves forward. I mentioned permitting uncertainty. No one has ever permitted a project this large. No one's ever permitted an 800-mile pipeline in the post-NEPA era in the U.S. Nobody's ever done an LNG plant this big or a gas treatment plant this big, and we'll need to do all three. We'll have to do all three in a coordinated manner under a single review process, which ostensibly would be coordinated through FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And they will help us by coordinating all the other federal and state agencies that would be involved in the Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration, PHMSA, you've got Coast Guard, you've got Seaways, you've got the EPA. I shouldn't forget the EPA. They'll be right there. So FERC helps you with that whole long list of federal agencies and permits to work through that, and all those challenges create risks. So if we get back to those three principles, you know, all of these touch the risks, so we pay very close attention to them so that we can manage them. And as we move forward, we're really just trying to finish our studies this year. We want to move into pre-FEED. We're hoping that we can get enough clarity out of the legislative session to understand the participants, the equity, and the process. One of our colleagues from BP who has defined it says, you know, we really need help with the three P's is the phrase that he uses. It's participants, project equity, and process. So that as you guys deliberate this and we provide you information, we really need your help to understand that so we can move into pre-FEED, which is a milestone in and of itself, and it's a level of project integration that we haven't had in Alaska before. So with that said, it's kind of the framework. I think folks have seen this. It's a quick schematic of what the Alaska LNG project would look like. So I'm going to just try and get through it as fast as I can here. Starting on the North Slope, we integrate the oil fields and gas fields, Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. They're kind of the anchor tenants because that's where the majority of the gas is. So There are other fields on the north slope with gas, but the majority of the gas is there. So if you kind of think of a real estate mall, these are the big anchor tenants in the mall. And there's plenty of room for other folks in the mall, but you want to know that you have anchor tenants so that when you build the mall, folks will come to the mall. So Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson give you that security. They're the anchor tenants. We have a pipeline that runs down to the down across the Brooks Range through discontinuous permafrost over the Alaska Range, across the Cook Inlet into the eastern Cook Inlet area with the lead plant site in Nikiski. So that's kind of a high-level overview of the project. But let's take a minute to look at each of the pieces. One of the first pieces is Point Thompson. It's about 60 miles east of Prudhoe Bay. About 25% of the gas is there. I think some of you folks have even had the opportunity to visit Prudhoe Bay or Point Thompson recently. They've invested about $1.8 billion to date. They're looking to invest about $4 billion to get the condensate on stream no later than early 2016. I have a little side bet with my good friend Gina, who's the project manager at Point Thompson, that if she doesn't beat that by 6 months, she buys me dinner. So we're watching that one closely. Unfortunately, that work is going really well. The ice roads are in, the airfield is in, the camp is in place, and they're finishing all the supports for the pipeline are in, and they're working on the pipeline right now between Thompson and Badami. The other big anchor tenant is Prudhoe Bay, and of course it is the anchor tenant because it's the largest oil field in North America. It has a tremendous amount of associated gas with it, but it had to be managed very carefully because oil and gas go together. And as we look at this project and we think about cost, the integration of Prudhoe Bay as an oil field underpinning this investment is very important. This project has tons of challenges. You know that it's got to have the gas treated, it's got to have the gas transported. Those are big challenges, and I heard your conversations earlier comparing this project with others. No other project has an 800-mile pipeline between the field and the plant. The one in Qatar is 26 miles. The one in Equatorial Guinea is about 10 miles. Normally, you can site the plant very close to the source. Here, given the reality of the Arctic conditions and the fact that you can't ship in the winter, you have to build this pipeline. You also have to deal with 12% CO2 out of Prudhoe, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that number in a minute, but those challenges have to be offset by other advantages. And one of those big advantages is you have an existing infrastructure where all the compression is already in place at Prudhoe supporting the oil field, and you can leverage that as long as the oil business stays healthy. You have that to underpin the gas business, and that's a really important advantage. If you ever don't have a healthy oil business, that moves from the advantage column to the disadvantage column because you'd have to recreate that, and that would be a real challenge. So if we look at the producing fields, I'll just show you a quick picture. You got Point Thompson, my right, I think it's your right, it's towards the center, and then you got Prudhoe Bay, and we'll show you a little bit more on that. We don't want to go there. After that, you've got to treat this gas. Once you get the gas out of Prudhoe and Thompson, you bring it into a facility which gets it ready to transport. One of the key things we've done is understand how you would get the gas ready to move to market. The market only wants the hydrocarbon gas that they can use for utility because that's what heats homes and keeps lights on and creates electricity and all the other benefits of energy. This gas has about 12% CO2 in it at Prudhoe Bay and about 4% CO2 at Thompson. So Thompson reservoir pressure is a little bit higher. It's about 10,000 PSI. Prudhoe Bay reservoir pressure is a little bit lower. It's 3,200 PSI or so. And it has about 12% CO2. So you have to look at those two systems and then design a gas treatment plant that works. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about it, but I just want to show you a quick summary of what the gas treatment plant would look like. It's been designed. We know that these towers we'll treat the gas such that we can strip out the impurities. It's an amine process, DMEA. They're about 130 feet tall. They're about 28 feet in diameter. The plate steel in the walls is about 8 to 12 inches thick. So these are enormous towers where you move the gas up and the liquid down so that the liquid strips all the impurities off. And the importance of that is the only thing that goes in that pipeline is very dry hydrocarbon gas. And when I say dry, that means there's no water. There are very small traces of hydrocarbon liquids like propane and butane, but it's inconsequential. There's not a lot of liquids because in Prudhoe Bay you've been cycling the gas for 30 years, which means the Prudhoe Bay operator has done a great job of taking the gas out of the ground, taking the liquids out, putting it intact, generating benefits for all the parties, and then putting it back in the ground. They've cycled the reservoir three times. In doing so, they've stripped most of the hydrocarbon liquids normally associated with gas. So this gas stream is almost all methane with a little bit of ethane, and that's very important because there's enough ethane in this that you can make a rich gas, a rich LNG stream at 1,100 BTUs that the Asian market really likes. So one of the things early on we were able to design is integrate the system and look at it so that we know we can make an LNG spec that people would want to buy, and we could put gas in that pipeline without any impurities, without any sort of contaminants that might represent corrosive risks, and in return, move that gas down a pipeline. This is a 42-inch system. It's about 3.3 billion cubic feet of gas off the North Slope. It's a 42-inch pipeline, notionally X80, but we're looking really hard at the materials. The type of material is really important because it defines the amount of steel in the line and the type of steel in the line, and that tells you who can make it, how many mills can you get it from, and what's it going to cost. So one of the things we have to study in pre-FEED is the material on that pipeline design. There's a lot of questions that we have to work, and those are all uncertainties. You know, where do you space crack arresters, and what exactly could you go to X70? Or there's little questions that drive huge value because the system is so big. Any little change you make is hundreds of millions of dollars of decisions, and it's that kind of uncertainty that we work on. We go from really big questions, multi-billion-dollar questions, and we just keep grinding it down. $100 million questions, $10 million questions, $1 million questions. That we get such a high level of certainty that you move to a place where the investors are ready to make a decision. They want to know that you've resolved all those uncertainties. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator French. Question.
On the size of the pipe, yeah, thank you. What's the maximum throughput? What can you get through a 42-inch pipeline?
Okay, this is a 42-inch system. The design pressure is 2050, about 2100 PSI. That's done so that you can use an ANSI 600 spec, which is a standard spec. It has 8 compression stations, which are notionally shown here. If you were to add compression stations in a 42-inch line, you could add another BCF. Gas is compressible. You can put as much gas as you want into any system as long as you have integrity in the wall to hold it and you have enough pressure to put it there. It's just a question of steel and pressure. I'll show you the pipeline for Point Thompson that's required for 10,000 PSI. And you can see what I'm talking about, because at some point what you get is a question where I'm trying to put so much gas in that the amount of money it costs me to add compression isn't worth it, and then I have to do something else. But this system does have the ability to expand, you know, another 25-30% as designed. We don't put that gas in today. You know, I get a sense that everybody wants more now. That's kind of the American way. You want to have 20 years of plateau so that when you go to the market and say, hey, we have LNG to sell, they're going to say, well, can you provide it for a long time? Because they don't want just LNG tomorrow. They want to know it's there for years and years, just like with the ConocoPhillips plant in Kenai that successfully delivered LNG to Japan for 40 years. That's what they want because they put their entire economy at risk. So you don't want to move too much gas too fast, so you balance that plateau. You don't want to take it too fast. You don't want to make it too slow. You're always kind of looking for that Goldilocks moment. We've balanced this system at about 20 years based on the resources we know at Prudhoe and Thompson. But if you bring in more, you can always expand. And the way the structure has been put forward is you have that capability on a unilateral basis. So as doing that, as I mentioned, you're going to get gas to Alaskans. That's really important. Our design contemplates 5 offtake points. It's roughly 350 million a day average. That swings between about 250 in the summer when it's warm and folks aren't heating their homes, and about 450 in the winter when folks are heating their homes and demand goes up. That seasonal swing is really important to me because we have to build the system to work on the coldest day of the year. That's the maximum capacity. The other 364 days, we just try and balance it because the volumes are lower, and we're trying to get all that gas that we move through the system that we don't deliver to Alaskans, we'll try and liquefy it. That gets back to the integrated view on the project. Because we've been able to work together and take an integrated view, we've been able to balance the system. We've been able to balance horsepower in the plant with idle capacity in the summer so that we always have the ability to move the gas, liquefy it, and move it. And I want to just pause for a second and talk about that integration because it's unique. In previous projects, because the other projects were firewalled off, they couldn't make those kinds of decisions. They only could see what was in the pipe, because they were about pipelines. They were about delivering from A to B. This is an integrated system where you see the resource, you know what's in the ground, You build the infrastructure and you deliver the gas to the buyer, and you can look at the whole system and have an integrated process model that understands the composition, pressure, temperature of the gas at every point in that model, so that when you build it, it's as efficient as possible. That was impossible in previous efforts because under FERC rules, they have to be firewalled off, so they couldn't do that. And I'll show you the GTP, and I'll get you to the benefit there as fast as I can. Once you get it down to the Eastern Cook Inlet, you build the liquefaction facility. The whole reason you build a liquefaction facility is liquid gas is very small, very dense. It's easy to move. If you could build a pipeline across the ocean to the Asian market and touch every single market, you might consider it because a pipeline's a very stable delivery source. But the costs and challenges of building a pipeline across the ocean are daunting, and you could never touch all the markets. So what an LNG plant allows you to do is have that flexibility with ships to touch any market that can buy your LNG. So it gives you the options to deliver gas to any market that can buy it. And all they do is they take this really cold LNG at minus 260 degrees F, and they warm it back up, and they use it as gas. To them, it's no different than pipeline gas. It's just been delivered in a liquid form, because delivering it in a liquid form is so much more efficient. It sounds simple, but if you think about it, to deliver the same volume of gas that you haven't liquefied would take 600 ships. If you liquefy it, you only need one. So the amount of shipping you need and the amount of infrastructure you need goes down by a factor of 600, and that's why you put the investment to build the plant. That's really what an LNG plant does, is it allows you to deliver gas 600 times more compactly and more efficiently than you can through a pipeline. Otherwise, you'd use a pipeline. The plant we're talking about is 3 5-MT trains. Those are very standard trains. They're kind of middle-sized trains. Some trains are smaller. The one that's currently in the Nikiski is just about 1 MT. It's a little bit bigger. Some of the larger trains that have been, as industry stepped out, got up to 3, then they went to 5, and now there are trains out there that are 8 MT. We're thinking 5 MT trains gives us the right flexibility and the right balance, and they give you about 15 to 18 million tons of LNG per year. We need 3 storage tanks for that, just so that you store it before you ship it. You need a berth to build that. It's a simple jetty with 2 berthing facilities. Let me show you a quick picture of the LNG plant, if I can get it to come out. There we go. The only point I wanted to make here is the annual LNG output is the same as about 40 years of gas to Alaskans, because there's so much resource that, you know, if you just think about it, 3.5 billion cubic feet is what you put in the system. Alaskans use about a tenth of that. In the winter, it's a little bit more, but on average, it's about a tenth.
Steve, question. Sure. Senator Machicki?
Yeah, just a quick one for you, Steve. Just storage capacity of the 3 tanks.
Yeah. What is it? They're 160s. And then I have some videos here on modular construction. Does anybody want to take the time to see them, or do you want me to blow on past them? I ask that with all due respect, because I want to use your time well. If you've seen them, that's okay.
Blow by.
Okay, there we go. Thanks. Let me give you some quick updates on some of the things that we've done. At Prudhoe Bay, we've continued to work on this integration. And I'm going to just talk about this a little bit more, because it is such an important difference between this project and other projects. Because you've been able to integrate it, we know how we would manage the CO2. In the upper right corner of that picture, that's a diagram of how the Prudhoe Bay operator would manage CO2 reinjection. CO2 reinjection is really important. It's 500 million cubic feet a day of CO2. That's more gas than Alaskans use. There's more CO2 that you have to reinject than Alaskans use every day. Over the life of the project, it's 4 trillion cubic feet. So what you want to do is work with the Prudhoe Bay operator to make sure all that CO2 gets used well, and the Prudhoe Bay operator has thought that through and has got a plan for how they'd use it. The other thing you see up there is a graphic on how you'd integrate the power systems. Again, by integrating, we've looked at how you'd loop the power grids and how you'd integrate them. But at Point Thompson, you can see here a quick picture of the layout where we're looking on design basis and requirements. And Senator French, there's a picture of the steel thickness required for 10,000 PSI. So what you're always thinking about is, how do you manage that? And I like to try and put 10,000 PSI in perspective. And I know a lot of you heard me say this, but if you look at the tip of your finger, that's 1 square inch, right? Just look at your finger. You'd have to balance 2 F-150s to be the equivalent of the pressure, the load on that pipe of 10,000 PSI. That's what 10,000 PSI, it's 10,000 pounds on every square inch of that pipe. So to handle that load, the pipe in that line, which is a recycle line on the high pressure side, it's about 4 inches thick. And because it is so thick, you have to have special welding capabilities, which we're working on. And you have to have the design thought through. And there's a diagram of how you would handle the compression and the integration of the systems, which I won't get into. But the point is, by integrating it, you can understand all that. You can deliver some benefits at the gas treatment plant, because by understanding all of the system, we've been able to redesign the gas treatment plant. Both APP and Denali thought they needed 4 GTP trains based on the public data. That's because Prudhoe Bay has a 12% CO2, but if you were able to take a really sharper pencil to it and understand the composition better and take a sharper pencil to the design of those really big towers that are 130 feet tall and 28 feet wide, inside them is a bunch of packing beads that allows the gas and the liquid to mix. And you want them to touch each other. And when they touch each other, the liquid strips out the impurities in the gas. So the better that you can cause them to talk to each other, the better you can integrate that, the better you can commingle that, the more efficient they are. So we were able to improve our technology with our packing in those towers. We were able to better understand the composition of the gas. We were able to go from 4 trains to 3 trains. That's a lot of money that we save, but more importantly, it means that the system in the north with 3 trains for treating is now balanced with the system in the south with 3 trains for liquefaction. So for operations and maintenance over the next 35 years, it's a much better balanced system. So this was a pretty big achievement for us that we've been working on over the last several months. It's a huge cost savings and risk reduction. So if we get back to the three things, this reduces costs, reduces risks, and helps us, you know, move the project forward. The pipeline is another place we've been continuing to work. We have
pause 1 second, Steve. Senator Bishop, question?
Yeah.
How many sea lifts to bring this on?
Great question. The APP design was 4 sea lift seasons using, I think it's like 120 different modules, up to 8,500 tons each. And that's, those are tons. Those aren't pounds. Again, if you think about it, that gas treatment plant is 250,000 tons. It's 140,000 F-150s, 200,000 Subarus. You got to move all that. The original plan was to do it over 4 sea lifts to try and do it over 3. Okay. I'm going to back this up, Senator Bishop. The original plan was 4 trains and 3 sea lifts. What we're thinking now is 3 trains and 4 sea lifts. And what we've did is we split out the trains and we pulled the utilities forward so that we said, build the utilities in the first year, and then as you bring in the trains, you can bring them up one at a time. And that allows you to balance the startup with the plant so that as you bring up the plant, you bring it up one at a time. So again, you've balanced the system. So right now what we're thinking is 3 trains, 4 sea lifts. The first sea lift, I think, is 80,000 tons. The second sea lift is about 100,000 tons, but I can get you those numbers because we've done that, and we've got it marked down. That color-coded graph, that shows what gets moved in each sea lift. The blue is the first sea lift. The orange, yellow, and green are the subsequent sea lifts. So that's how it gets balanced out. So it's 4 sea lifts.
Yes, Senator Machiki had a question also, Steve.
Well, Steve, as you know, I have little experience in this field, but one area, so reinjection of CO2, I don't have any experience with dilution.
Yeah.
So you're going to increase the cost of handling CO2 just because it's going to be a higher proportion of the gas through the years.
Well, the way you're there, the Prudhoe Bay operator is going to manage that is they've got the miscible injection system, which has been handling the higher vapor pressure liquids that you couldn't put in taps. They've been putting it in for years. And that system is designed to handle up to 25% CO2. So what you do is you flush gas through that system to reduce the gas to kind of the low level or about 12%. And then you come backwards and bring it in and re-inject that gas till you come up to 25%. And as you go from east to west and you see the CO2 rates go up, you shut in the wells and you just keep moving.
I see. Okay.
And frankly, you know, I think the Prudhoe Bay operator has done an outstanding job thinking this through and come up with some great ideas. What I think is really exciting is if we give them a couple more years to work it, I think they're going to come up with stuff that's even better. You know, because you've got four trillion cubic feet of energy, and the question is, how do you use it? And what they've come up with are great ideas, but they'll get better ones because they're a smart bunch.
Thank you.
So here's the pipeline. I'm going to go through really quick. The challenge here is, how do you move through some of the more difficult areas? Attigan Pass, as we all know, is tall, and it's challenging because it's already got a pipeline. The Denali National Park area is particularly challenging. Everybody's been to Glitter Gulch. It's a tight area. There's not a lot of room for pipelines. There's a picture in the lower left of that picture that shows three different ways you can move the pipeline through Denali. They're all questions of how closely do you follow the terrain and where do you use bridges. The other challenge is, how do you cross the Cook Inlet and the Yukon River? We're pretty sure you cross the Yukon with a bridge. We're trying to work on the Cook Inlet right now. It's a question of where and how you cross the Susitna. One option is just stay on the west side. Other options are move to the east, and we really just don't know right now. That's the work we're working on, and we're trying to finish that over the next few weeks. But the line as it's designed right now is in that picture on the right. You can see it comes all the way down, and there's a couple options to get across the inlet. I think what's really exciting is you've got a fully integrated team of people from all the companies looking at that, and I think when they bring forward their routing recommendation, there's six primary engineers working on it, and between them they have like 200 years of experience working on this line, so I'm pretty sure that they'll come up with some good ideas. And then you've got the LNG plant. This is a quick picture of some MetOcean data that's out there that's monitoring sea states, current, ice. There's been a lot of questions about managing larger LNG carriers in the inlet because of the presence of ice. We've done a lot of work on that issue. We've done some modeling with the Alaskan pilots. We've gone to Gothenburg, where they have the world's best ice modeling systems. We've looked at the way they manage it in the St. Lawrence Seaway. And with some intrinsically safe design, we think that we can put some caissons to manage any ice flow and protect the LNG carriers when they're moored. We'll also have a set of fairly large tugs to support the LNG carriers when they move. So we think we can manage through that. And then, as I mentioned, we finished the environmental work. You can see there's a little scope there. We were, you know, some of you were able to join us up in Coldfoot. We appreciated your time. Thanks for that. See the work for yourselves. But here's a picture of what they do. And with that said, I think, you know, we've got some stuff on the 2014 summer field season, but that kind of gives you an overview of the project. I'm just going to summarize it by going back to that arc of success. You know, if we can keep alignment and integrate, this project can see and do things that its predecessors couldn't do. Our challenge is to keep understanding the risks and reducing them so that we can minimize cost of supply, because that's what makes a project successful. That's the only thing that you can really point at that helps a project survive. We can talk about hundreds of different issues. But what you're really doing is measuring their impact on your ability to deliver LNG at the lowest possible cost, because that's what makes you competitive. It's also what secures your margin. And if you can't get all those hundreds of factors and elements aligned to support the lowest possible cost of supply, you need to keep working it, because that's really our challenge, is to get all that stuff aligned to reduce risk and reduce cost. So.
Very good. Questions? Steve, you articulated your experience at the very outset. What would your role be, theoretically, should this project go forward in the Alaska LNG project?
Well, right now I work as the project manager under an agreement we call the Concept Selection Agreement. We have a lead party, and I work for that lead party on behalf of the whole project. The next phase would be to move into what we call a joint venture agreement, where you define a lead party, and that lead party would define a person to fulfill the same role I have, which is kind of the lead project manager role. If they want me to keep doing it, I'll keep doing it, but you know, that one's not written down in stone, and I don't want to be presumptive. So.
Great. Any other questions? Very good. Thank you very much, Steve.
Sure.
Appreciate the presentation.
Okay.
With that, we're going to adjourn, but I first want to just review. Our next meeting is on Wednesday. We have two meetings that day. The first meeting is at noon, and that'll be a joint meeting with House Resources. We'll be hearing our annual mining industry overview and update. The second meeting will be at our usual time, 3:30. We're going to hear a panel presentation on the Heads of Agreement document. So we're talking now about the participants in that Heads of Agreement document. Following that, the committee will take up a bill, Senate Bill 148, Kachemat Bay Critical Habitat Area. So it'll be another full meeting. So thanks very much. At this time, I will adjourn the meeting. The time is 5:55 p.m.